Support for WMNF comes from our members and Creative Loafing, in print and on the street every Thursday and online all the time at cltampa.com. In addition to news and politics, music, food and drink, arts and entertainment, and their green community, CL has recently launched two new sites, sports and LGBT, cltampa.com. I'm Duncan Strauss, and I'm really delighted to be bringing you another edition of Talking Animals, in which we'll be discussing dogs from new science-based perspectives, as presented in the book Dog Sense, written by our guest John Bradshaw. First, though, as always, we're kicking off the show with the animal tune, a shaggy dog story, as it were. This is Pokey Lafargue and the South City Three with Old Black Dog here on Talking Animals.
Oh, I hear that dog a-panting. It's old black dog when I'm gone. It's old black dog when I'm gone. When I come back with that $10 bill, see if anywhere you've been so long. My daddy, he was a gambler.
Yeah,
and he taught me how to play. It's very easy. Taught me how to bet my money on these two jack and train. That's how you play. It's old black dog when I'm gone. It's old black dog when I'm gone. When I come back with that $10 bill, it's honey where you've been so long.
Where you been, boy?
Kentucky, sweet home, in the state of Tennessee, I like it there. Anywhere I lay this little hat of mine, shall be home, sweet home to me. With this old black dog when I'm gone, with this old black dog when I'm gone. When I come back with that $10 bill, say,
honey, where you been so long?
Where you been?
Train is a rolling, huh? It's getting my casket low. Taking it on down to the graveyard, where the grave will be my home.
With old black dog when I'm gone.
It's old black dog when I'm gone. When I come back with that $10 bill, it is funny where you've been so long.
That was Pokey Lafargue and the South City Three with Old Black Dog, complete with sound effects. Animal Song of Sorts teases into today's edition of Talking Animals. My name's Duncan Strauss, here by Memrex in this case, with our program that is devoted to all subjects in the animal kingdom. In just a few minutes, we'll be hearing from today's guest, John Bradshaw, Foundation Director of the Anthrozoology Institute at the University of Bristol. His new book, Dog Sense, How the New Science of Dog Behavior Can Make You a Better Friend to Your Pet, draws on science and research to shake up the landscape for dog owners and trainers, debunking such concepts as the pack notion of dog behavior and the value of physical punishment in training dogs. We'll discuss all this and more when we hear from John Bradshaw in a few moments here on Talking Animals. Also a bit later in the show, we'll step into the comedy corner, which involves animal comedy. We'll play Name That Animal Tune. The winner will receive a copy of John Bradshaw's book, Dog Sense. And we'll hear some more animal songs, One that's dog-related and another that's a selection from the Talking Animals Festival CD that you could one day own if you play your cards right. Of course, by pledging $50. That's crucial. Right now, though, it's time for talking for the Animal News and Announcements segment. A look at items of interest in animal news as well as announcements of local events on the horizon. So let's turn now to interesting and or notable developments in animal news. Let's talk turkey, as it were. Produced, as always, by the Talking Animals award-winning Rip and Read News Department. Our first item really involves news more directly pertaining to WMNF and Talking Animals, by which I mean, probably heard by now, that Governor Scott has vetoed the legislature's budget, cutting all funding for public broadcasting in Florida, including WMNF. WMNF will lose $62,000 in our fiscal year that starts October 1st. That represents a significant hit for WMNF, and it's possible the station will have to cut services or programming that we currently provide. On a very related note, WMNF's Summer Fun Drive is scheduled to start July 12th, and the Talking Animals Fun Drive show will take place Wednesday, July 13th at 11 a.m. That's 2 weeks from today. So particularly in the wake of Governor Scott's budget slashing, it's very important that we're extremely successful financially in our fun drive and on the Talking Animals Fun Drive show in particular. So it'll be a great, great help, tremendously helpful if you could consider supporting us now via our tip jar. And so you find our tip jar, if you don't already know, you just go to WMNF.org, find the schedule, the programming schedule, find Talking Animals, of course, Wednesday at 11 a.m., and just click on that, and you'll get the Talking Animals page, and in the upper right-hand corner of that is the tip jar. And if you could slip in $25, if you can spare $50, $100, something like anything that you can help us with, it would just make it nice to start off with a little money in our pocket for the Fun Drive show. So, again, if you've liked what we've done here on Talking Animals, especially in the expanded weekly hour-long format, like the Talking Animals Festival, just want to support us on just general principle even, please help us that way. Slip something in the slip jar, tip jar now. Otherwise, again, if you would like to get a jump on pledging for the July 13th show, but beforehand, please email me, duncan@wmnf.org, and we can make arrangements however you'd like to do it so that you can help us that way. We really, really need and count on your support here to keep Talking Animals and WMNF rolling along. So, and no good deed goes unpunished or unthanked. So we'll have thank you gifts, including a week's stay at a Hawaiian condo at the Poipu Beach area on the island of Kauai. We have a really cool special Mexican whale watching trip courtesy of Baja Expeditions to hang with the so-called friendly whales in Baja, California. Those are where those California gray whales go down. They migrate down. The mothers give birth. And then in sort of a phenomenon unknown, I think anywhere else in the world, the mothers in this little lagoon bring their babies over to meet you if you're in these little sort of outboard skiffs, and they're not okay with you getting near their babies. They bring them over, and you get to know them, and you touch them and pet them, and it's pretty amazing, and it's all cool. And so we'll have you we have a nice trip little package for that if you're interested, and we'll also have thank you gifts to suit all levels of donations, really. So if that might be a little out of your price range, then we have stuff like the CD recorded at the second Talking Animals Festival in April. 13 bands performing animal songs, including Maga Dog, Sons of Hippies, Pete Gallagher, The Dirty Trash and Spoons Review, and The Sun Society, whose contribution we'll hear to close out today's show. So again, please email me today at duncan@wmnf.org for ways you can help support Talking Animals and WMNF in our summer fun drive. Really, really appreciate it. Let's see, looking at a couple of actual news items here. This is from a few days ago, but still, Dateline Butler from the North Jersey.com, the record there. It also, a controversy sells. It starts off, it also brings out dozens of protesters if you happen to be a superstar athlete and admitting dog killer, charging upwards of $120. Autographs. So was the scene for Michael Vick on Main Street, where hundreds gathered Sunday to either lambast the quarterback for running a dogfighting ring or praise him for leading the Philadelphia Eagles to the NFL playoffs. Vick, who admitted in court to helping drown or hang at least six canines, spent more than 2 hours at Butler Sports Cards quietly taking photos with fans and signing autographs, while three dozen police officers kept the peace outside. No arrests were reported. Vic was brought to the store by co-owner Jeff Robbins, who charged $90 for signed mini helmets, cards, and 8x10 photos, and $119 for regulation helmets, footballs, and other larger items. Quote, "I'm not bringing him in because he killed dogs," Robbins said before the session. "I'm bringing him in because he's the biggest autograph draw out there right now." Okay. And from Colorado, from 9newswebsite.com, there's this. Dateline Denver, National Mill Dog Rescue, a nonprofit outside of Colorado Springs that rescues dogs from dog mills, received a mobile unit Monday from the North Shore Animal League America. The mobile unit will help the nonprofit transport dogs that have been rescued and are up for adoption to other metropolitan areas in Colorado and across the country. The vehicle made its way from New York to Denver this past weekend and was on display Monday afternoon at a Petco in Denver. NMDR did not previously have a rescue vehicle, and the director says this will be a big help in their efforts to save dogs and find them homes. For us, this is so incredibly exciting, Teresa Strader, director of National Mill Dog Rescue, said. And we went from this elation and such an incredible feeling of happiness and joy to just bawling our eyes out. So National Mill Dog Rescue has rescued almost 5,000 dogs since it was founded in 2007. So just in a specific region, nice to see those things going on and supporting dog rescue and making it easier for people, good people, to help animals. So, all right, that's going to do it for this edition of Animal News and Announcements for today. Let's step now into the Talking Animals Comedy Corner, which involves animal-oriented comedy. This is Robert Schimmel with a piece called Swimming with a Dolphin on today's Comedy Corner on Talking Animals.
I take my family on the road sometimes, and it's fun going with them. And my daughter saw this billboard, Swim with the Dolphins, and she's like, "Dad, I want to do that." I said, "You know, that's not right. They're supposed to be free in the ocean like God intended, not in a freak show at SeaWorld." And she said, "I always wanted to swim with the dolphins." Yeah. Always? Or since you signed? Because I don't remember ever hearing about it before. But we go there, and for what they charge, you should be able to swim with the Miami Dolphins. I said, "Look, here's how it's going to work. You walk near the edge of the pool, I'll bump into you. You slip and fall in there, pet him a few times, and then let's go here." Yeah, no, she don't want to do it like that. "It's only fun if I pay." So then you pay, and they take you in a room where they got a guy that tells you what you can do and what you can't do when you're in the water with the dolphin. And he's got a scar from here across his face like that. Yeah. Like, he kind of knows what you're not supposed to do. And he says, "Rule number one, do not stick anything into the blowhole." And that did it for me right there. I'm on the floor crying, and my kids, "Yeah. Are you kidding?" And she's like, "Dad, it's not funny." And I said, "Yes, it is." And I'll tell you why. Because that means somebody already stuck something in the blowhole. And basically what they're saying is they don't want it to happen again. Okay, now you can pet the dolphin's nose. Don't grab his tail. No poking in the eye. No poking in the eye? Wow, the place down the street, they give you a stick to... And then he says, "Boys and girls, the dolphin's got a real soft belly, and you can rub his belly, but don't go past where the belly button would be, because he's got the same thing you've got." And I said, "The dolphin's got herpes?" "Well, how do I have that?" Hey, you start talking like that, and that pool empties real fast. And you have an opportunity to have some real quality one-on-one time with the dolphin while everyone else is rinsing off.
All right. That was the late, great, truly great, Robert Schimmel with a piece called Swimming with a Dolphin, taken from his album Life Since Then, live from New York. I'm Duncan Strauss. This is Talking Animals. Our website is talkinganimals.net. It's nearly time to hear from today's guest, John Bradshaw. As I mentioned earlier, John is the foundation director of the Anthrozoology Institute at the University of Bristol, a longtime academic and scientist specializing in animal welfare and behavior. His new book, Dog Sense, How the New Science of Dog Behavior Can Make You a Better Friend to Your Pet, draws on research and studies, his own and that of many colleagues, to challenge long-held concepts about rearing, training, and living with dogs. So, in a conversation recorded last week, this is John Bradshaw on Talking Animals. All right, let's welcome John Bradshaw to Talking Animals. Thanks so much for joining us today, John.
That's a pleasure.
Congratulations on Dog Sense. The book has been out the better part of 2 months, I guess, at least in this country. So I'd be curious how you feel about the reaction it's generated thus far.
Well, I'm obviously delighted that so many people in America are interested in the science behind dog behavior. There's obviously a tremendous interest in dog training, as portrayed on TV and in other media. But I'm obviously very gratified that some of the science, which is kind of telling a slightly different story, has gained so much interest.
Right. Well, you know, in the final pages of the book, I was kind of struck by this passage where you say dog training is one area in which the new canine science has met with strong resistance, to the point where some trainers and self-proclaimed behavior experts have openly and deliberately attacked the credentials of those trying to disseminate reliable science-based information. And then almost in sort of real time, I've seen some fairly dismissive even comments about the book, the points you make on forums and comment section of websites, things like, have you ever tried to deny attention to a 50-pound German Shepherd, new science, baloney, none of this information is new, and sorry, but this guy knows nothing about training dogs. I think he's trying to trash Cesar Millan's reputation as fodder for his promo, Cesar Rocks. So, I mean, that's just sort of a small and random sampling of some comments I've seen, and certainly, obviously, some Cesar Millan loyalists mixed in there. But clearly, even in a field that's inherently polarizing, you seem to have struck a nerve or two. Maybe for the benefit of those listening who haven't yet had a chance to read the book, you could sort of outline the key tenets of dog training that you suggest could be either reexamined or, some of the practices that are employed in one camp that might be considered outdated at this point.
Yes, the book is not a dog training book. I don't want anyone to think they will get a lot of training tips from buying it. I do talk about one specific area of training, which we can maybe come on to a bit later, but in terms of giving practical advice, it's a very neglected area, teaching your dog how to cope with being left alone.
Sure.
But the more conventional kind of training, I'm not a dog trainer. What I'm offering here is for anybody, whether they're a dog trainer or just a dog owner, an insight into what has been going on in the world of canine science over the past 10 years or so. There has been a huge amount of work done. Biologists of many different kinds have got very interested in the dog in the last 10 years in a way that really hasn't happened for probably half a century before that. And most of this information is just only available to other academics and veterinarians. It's not out there. And so I felt really compelled almost to get this stuff to dog owners so they can make their own decisions about how to train their dogs, what kind of a trainer to look for. Essentially, what the new science says is, first of all, that dogs are not wolves, that they have been completely altered by domestication, so that the idea that you can essentially use wolf behavior as a kind of automatic primer for anything, for understanding anything a dog does, I think is completely wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, most of what has been put forward as suitable for borrowing from wolves to dogs, and particular dominance theory. Again, the wolf biologists do not support dominance theory anymore. They regard the wolf pack as a family unit where, far from the parents dominating the offspring, it's the other way around. The offspring volunteer to stay and help. They could go off and set up their own packs, but they're probably just too young and inexperienced to do that successfully. So it's a much more harmonious unit than the one that is portrayed in the old books on wolf behavior, and indeed on many in many books on dog behavior.
And
so once you kind of remove that whole basis of dog behavior as being you need to dominate your dog all the time, I think you can then re-examine the whole basis of training methods and see whether, in fact, those methods, particularly the harsher methods, the ones that rely on physical punishment, are really necessary, or whether there are alternatives.
Right. It does seem like, as you say, once you sort of recognize the dogs as wolves, things has been, you know, largely repudiated in that way, the whole landscape shifts in terms of how you approach dogs, how you approach dog training, or at least that it could, if not should.
Yes, my stance on it really is that most people these days have dogs as companions.
Yeah.
Therefore really want to have a good affectionate relationship with that dog. To simultaneously want to have an affectionate relationship with the dog and also to have to think of it as being some kind of enemy agent in your house that's trying to take you over and control your life seems to me to be really two beliefs that are quite difficult to hold side by side. But if you switch over to the reward-based training, then I think those two things, are, the training and the relationship, are actually much more easy to reconcile with one another.
Absolutely, and as you sort of point out, I mean the implications really of the kind of philosophical gulf between the sort of physical punishment side and the reward base, I mean, are significant in all kinds of ways, including that, if there are animal trainers who may be inept or inconsistent, next thing you know, you have a number of dogs who are abandoned as, hey, we couldn't seem to train this dog or get his or her behavior in line. And then from there, there's that many more dogs that unfortunately may be euthanized.
Yeah, I think it's obviously very unfortunate that so many dogs are euthanized due to behavioral disorders. I'm not a trainer, I'm not a clinician,
sure.
But I've worked very closely with both throughout my career, throughout the last 25 years. And basically, the people I've worked with tell me, and I can see it with my own eyes in the dogs that they treat, is that most of these problems go back to, are based on fear and anxiety. The dog is unable to cope with a situation and, for whatever reason, usually because it's worked in the past, it will eventually resort to aggression in order to simply get itself out of a situation in which it feels very uncomfortable. And most of those issues go right back to the early life of the dog when it was badly socialized. It could be simply inadequately socialized, that it was not exposed to the right range of situations when it was a puppy and a young dog, or it could actually be negative. It could have been punished by, severely by a particular person and then when the dog meets a person who looks like that other person later on in life, then its gut reaction is going to be, let's get out of here. And if I can't get out of here because I'm on the end of a leash, then I'm going to open my mouth and use my teeth. So
sure.
These things pretty much all stem back to problems early on in life, but they are in the majority of cases correctable.
Right. And what do you think, John, is the prospect of there being any sort of either reconciliation amongst these two camps or any sort of meeting in the middle? I mean, it just seems that among the problems with having these sort of distinct camps is that we are nowhere near any developing any sort of set, as you point out too, of sort of recognized standards for dog trainers. Partly, I'm going to guess, because there are such huge philosophical differences in amongst the training world. But then people don't really know how to assess in a clear-cut way in terms of lacking those standards. Hey, what should I get? I'm new to dogs. This is my first dog, let's say. Where do I go? How do I determine what's best?
Yeah, the whole business of the regulation of dog training and behavioral correction disorder, behavioral disorder counselling and so on is a very vexed one and a very difficult one, both here in the UK and I gather also in the USA. As you say, there are several different approaches. I think it's slightly more complicated than two, but it's quite often easy to polarize it into two.
Sure.
My impression has been over the past year or so, anyway, that there has been some move towards some kind of a reconciliation between the two. But I think between the two approaches. But I think it will be very difficult to get the more humane orientated people to ever accept punishment, except in extreme circumstances. In the book, I say, you know, you can punish a dog, but you don't have to use physical means. You don't have to exert pain on the dog. A dog that is bonded to you, or even just interested in you, if it's a dog you don't know very well, you can punish it simply by rewarding it consistently and then suddenly stopping the reward. The dog gets quite anxious at that point because it wants to pursue the relationship, which it's hitherto found a positive experience, and then suddenly this reward is withdrawn. The dog, it's a great way of getting a dog's attention, and I've spoken to a lot of trainers who've removed themselves from the punishment camp and said, no, actually, I find this reward-based training works much better. But don't kid anybody that I don't use punishment. I do use punishment, but it's not the physical kind. It is simply withdrawing affection or a food reward, whatever it is you're doing that the dog likes. Suddenly withdrawing it when the dog stops doing what you want it to do is as effective a method of getting the dog's attention and persuading it to do what you want it to do as hitting it over the nose.
Sure, sure. Well, it's and a far cry from choke chains and that whole realm. So let me let folks know this is Talking Animals. We're speaking with the animal behaviorist John Bradshaw about his new book, Dog Sense, How the New Science of Dog Behavior Can Make You a Better Friend to Your Pet. This conversation was recorded last week. So something you just touched on, John, a bit ago that I'd like to explore a bit further is there seems to be scientific evidence beyond what many of us would more informally characterize as eager to please. I mean, dogs as puppies, you point out, start observing us and keep incorporating those observations. I mean, what are they doing and what are they after in those first puppy years?
Well, what we've done to the dog during the course of domestication, and this must have happened thousands of years ago. Don't forget that for example, the leash, the collar and leash, would have is a comparatively recent invention, at least in terms of the majority of dogs. Most people wouldn't have been able to afford to put one together like that to use on a dog all the time. Most dogs have followed people around spontaneously for thousands of years, and it's only with urbanization that we've had to suddenly say, okay, every dog needs to be on a leash. This spontaneous following around, it doesn't come from nowhere. It must have come from a change in the dog's brain during the course of domestication. I advanced the theory, and it's no more than that in the book, that maybe the wolves that were originally domesticated already had this in them to a certain extent, and all we had to do was mold it, because modern wolves certainly don't. But anyway, whether that's true or not, dogs now have an inbuilt desire to bond with people. They get this pretty much from the minute their eyes open at 2 to 3 weeks old, and they're really primed to learn all about people from that moment, really, well, through their whole lives, but particularly the first 3, 4, 5 months. That's why a whole proper socialization program is so important for dogs. They need to be exposed to a whole range of the kinds of experiences, kinds of people, kinds of environments that they're going to need to learn about and cope with in adult life.
Sure. Well,
they need to get that exposure pretty early on. And they have this unique ability to form two completely different sets of rules, a set of rules for how to get along with dogs, their own kind, and another set of rules for how to get along with people and the human environment. And that's pretty unique. There's only one or two other animals that have that.
Right. Well, one thing along those lines that I think it was in the chapter about canine brain power, you note that one area where dogs actually outpace chimpanzees is their ability to kind of extract information from what humans are doing, and in particular their ability to read human faces and gestures. Maybe you could talk a little bit more about that. I found that really fascinating.
That is, it's a remarkable thing. I mean, I think it's one of those things where biologists, in this case primatologists, kind of were brought up short. I think when those experiments were done, well, the first ones of those experiments were done, I think the people who did them were confidently expecting that chimpanzees were going to outperform dogs, and they were quite surprised, I think, that it was exactly the other way around. That chimpanzees are very good at understanding other chimpanzees, but they don't have this flexibility. Even a hand-raised chimpanzee doesn't have this flexibility to, as I said, have kind of two sets of rules in maybe different parts of the brain. We don't know that for sure, but it's a kind of convenient way of thinking about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how to get along with your own kind and how to get along with people. And so dogs do that very easily, particularly, as I said, if they've been socialized well when they're very young. I mean, there's still argument among scientists about just how much of that ability they're born with and how much is learned, but it's almost certainly a mixture of both. But even that has its limitations. I mean, you know, dogs are very, very smart, but there's been some fascinating work done by a scientist in Paris looking at dogs that help blind people in their homes. And she has found that these dogs, even though they've been living with these people for 2-3 years, they have never worked out that those people can't see, they will follow the direction in which those people, the blind people's head is pointing, even when it's completely the wrong direction. So this, you know, once dogs learn this, it seems to be they can't unlearn it. And that's, you know, so they're smart, but in another way, they're kind of not as flexible as human beings would be.
So they can't make those kind of finer point distinctions or adaptations even while they're well serving those folks. Another sort of related kind of interesting point among many small and large that emerged from your book is that dogs are not born particularly friendly to humans, that it's only sort of from those interactions with humans, especially at a pivotal point, that kind of almost turns on that friendliness, that connection, and then really doesn't, if it seems like from one of the things you cited there, if it gets much beyond 12 weeks or thereabouts and they haven't had that kind of interaction, then it starts to be too late to be able to turn on that element.
Yeah, we see very few of these unsocialized dogs, completely unsocialized dogs these days. It used to be quite a common thing in breeding kennels where the dogs were not properly looked after. You know, they saw very few people, or maybe only one kind of person. I regrettably, I think that still the case in some puppy mills and over here.
Yeah.
We call them puppy farms over here in the UK, but I think it's pretty much the same deal.
Mm-hmm.
Where maybe only one person sees the dog and maybe only a couple of times a day, and that dog learns about that person, and if that person is a female, for example, it'll probably accept women, but then it may not accept men. It may be very scared of men. It may be scared of their low-pitched voices or their appearance or whatever. So it's not just, you know, that they're very ready to learn, but they can't learn it from books. They have to be given the actual living experiences of all these different things. And if you look on, you know, the websites of the people who specialize in this kind of thing, you'll see big checklists of things that you should introduce your puppy to, pages of stuff,
mm-hmm.
To make sure that it's well balanced, that it, and there's an extra dimension to this as well, because the more things that a puppy meets, not only does it have the direct experiences of those things, but it also gets better coping mechanisms for the unknown. You know, you can't protect a puppy against everything.
Sure.
Something will happen to it that you haven't been able to foresee. That's just life.
Right.
But if the puppy is mentally tough, if it knows that, yeah, I cope with this, I cope with that, I'm not saying it can think like this, but the process seems to work. You build mental toughness so that the puppy is interested in new things rather than being frightened by them.
Sure. Well, and kind of on a somewhat related note, in terms of things that could be frightening or cause anxiety, I mean, in your discussion of separation problems, you make points about whether dogs love people more than they love other dogs, citing a study that dogs indeed are prone to bonding more strongly with people than with other dogs. And sort of influenced by our own dog here at the house. I'm curious if you could extrapolate from that study or your own years of research and experience to what extent the gender of the owner or owners might make a difference in that bond. For example, our dog Daisy, we adopted and she, you know, came along after a while and been fostered somewhere where we knew they were great people. But prior to that, we suspect that there was some sort of big, sort of dark-haired, swarthy man that was mean or abusive in some way, because early on and even now, if somebody fitting that description, it could be the nicest guy, most dog-friendly guy in the world, comes in, she backs off, and she is incredibly, you know, from the get-go, she can meet any kind of woman who, you know, she never knew 2 seconds ago, you know, immediately warms up. I mean, she's fine with me. I'm the, you know, the man that she probably dislikes the least or likes the most. But I wonder if there are other things like that where there's a gender element of that human that further separates how they respond or how they bond, and connect.
Yeah, I don't think there's anything, that about gender that is kind of automatic as far as dogs are concerned. I don't think they're kind of bred or have an instinctive preference for males, for men or women. There has been some scientific literature that has suggested this, but then when people have checked it out, they found the exact opposite. So, you know, some studies have found that rescue dogs prefer men to women, and then others have found the opposite. I think it's much more to do with the background of the individual dog,
yeah.
And what its formative experiences have been, and that of course they remember punishment or just frightening aversive experiences much longer and much more deeply than they remember pleasurable ones. Pleasurable ones you need to keep repeating. Obviously, that, you know, with a good relationship, that's automatic. It just comes as part of the relationship.
Sure.
But they do remember things that you know, have happened to them in the past. One of the things I would do if I'm meeting an unfamiliar dog and somebody's saying, you know, this dog shows a little bit of anxiety, is just very gently raise my hand beside my shoulder. A dog that's been beaten in the past will start to cringe as soon as it sees that hand coming up. It doesn't have to be fast, and you certainly don't have to lower it again or even approach the dog.
Mm-hmm.
But that, they will latch onto that, because most people, if they're going to hit a dog, will raise their hand first. And the number of dogs that I've seen do that, and then you really have to desensitize that as part of the rehabilitation of that animal. But in terms of the gender, I don't think that, you know, that apart from individual experiences, dogs have a particular preference for either men or women.
Sure, it's case by case based on what their early life or early training, as you kind of alluded to earlier, you know, was like, and how that shaped that dog's experience. And sort of speaking of sort of separation problems, and you touched on this earlier, and I would like to come back to it indeed, is just kind of the rather, you know, I think simple, if done well, techniques that you recommend for getting dogs who often do have problems when their owners leave the house for the day to go to work, school, wherever they're going. And how that can really be pretty simply mitigated.
Yeah, one of the messages in the book is really based on the research that I've been doing with my colleagues over the past 10 years or so, is that this whole business of leaving a dog on its own is a seriously underestimated, underemphasized problem. Most dogs, at some time in their life, our surveys have shown, and whether that's in the United States as well as in the UK, dislike and show signs of disliking being left alone sometime during their lifetime, which lasts for more than a few weeks. In some cases, it goes on for years. There are other dogs which the owners are completely unaware that the dog is upset when they leave the house, because it doesn't do anything so dramatic that the neighbors hear something or there's a mess when they come back. But nevertheless, the dog is clearly, from its body language, very anxious, and we found this out by putting, you know, video recorders into people's homes.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a very widespread problem. Millions of dogs suffer from this at some time in their lives, and the sad thing is that, the thing you can do something about it, of course, is that they can be trained to cope with being left alone if you get them straight away. So I would say one of the things I'm trying to promote with the book is You know, you do basic training with a puppy. You do the sit. You do the house training, the house breaking. You train the puppy not to bounce up when you have visitors in the house. The very basic bits of canine manners.
Mm-hmm.
Added to that should be you should teach your dog to be without you. And it's very simple. You need to go through the usual routine of leaving the house, which the dog by that time will probably know anyway. But then once you get to the door, you turn back and reward the dog with whatever the dog likes best. It may be food. It may be just praise. It may be a game with a ball. It depends on the individual dog, just what they like best. Then once the dog has established that, you can then go to the point of going through the door and then coming straight back in again. And then once the dog is happy with that, you can go to the stage of going down to the other end of, out to the street and then back in again, and so on, and making that gap longer and longer, but very, very gradually increasing the length of the gap between leaving and coming back. What happens in the dog's mind is that the dog associates you going out with you coming back, which, we would think that's just such an obvious thing that a dog should know it instinctively, but all the research says they don't know that. If you leave without training that you're coming home, they don't know whether you, they really genuinely don't know whether you're coming home or not, and they get anxious. So it's terribly easy to do as part of the basic dog training of the dog when you get the new dog. It is very difficult to correct once it's been established for months or even years. So sure. That's prevention is really much better than cure in this particular instance.
Absolutely. Well, this is Talking Animals. My guest is John Bradshaw, Foundation Director of the Anthrozoology Institute at the University of Bristol. We're discussing his new book, Dog Sense, in a conversation recorded last week, and we're in the final moment or two probably, John, but many things I'd love to further explore with you. But one, I guess, is, of course, it may not surprise too many folks that a dog's sense of smell is important, but how important it is and the implications of it may come as a surprise to some, and again, even more recent advances about how that can really be used to serve others. I mean, for example, one of your research partners is the medical detection dogs. Maybe you could talk about some of the work going on in that area.
Yeah, we're making new uses. We're finding new uses for the dog, and particularly the dog's nose all the time, which, means that the dog is just such a remarkable animal. We've been using dogs for all sorts of things for thousands of years.
Sure.
And here we are in the 21st century finding new uses. So hopefully that means dogs will be with us for a very long time to come, and obviously I hope that will be the case. The work that I'm involved with medical detection dogs is really remarkable. I mean, what we're doing here is making use of the dog's ability to detect very small changes in their owner. We think it's mostly due to odor. The dogs are certainly trained using odor, but I think with a real live owner, they're probably picking up on body language as well. And what we're talking about here is people who have very unstable diabetes, for example, people who have epilepsy, people who have Addison's disease, and have very sudden episodes, which very often require hospitalization, which if they could predict them, they could take medication and prevent the incident ever happening, which is good for their health and obviously very good for medical budgets as well.
Mm-hmm.
Some of these dogs do this spontaneously, and they can be brought out by training. It can sometimes be the person's own dog that shows signs of it, but it's also possible to train them from scratch, either the person's own dog or a dog that's provided by the charity. And they're trained on odor. They're trained on the difference between the odor of somebody, for example, in a diabetic coma versus somebody who is perfectly normal, or the same person when they're perfectly normal. The dog can learn the difference. And then do this alerting. I mean, all they do is they do something like sit down and wag their tail and stare at the person, and they'll go, okay, now I need to take a blood test.
Wow.
They can do this while the person's asleep, which is, clearly not only remarkable, but also incredibly beneficial, because sometimes such people do slip into a coma while they're asleep and can be very difficult to revive.
Sure.
I think that's, just a wonderful thing that we're able to use dogs like this, because, as I say, it means dogs will be with us for a while. But I think if you if you accept that dogs have these wonderful noses, then I think you need to accept that, you know, that all dogs have these, not just these special working dogs, and to respect that in all dogs by giving them things to sniff.
Right, and in fact, you know, I guess I hadn't fully realized till just now that in some cases some of those folks, you know, just the dogs they have on hand rather than a certain kind of, you know, retriever or a certain kind of dog that you would think might be specifically trained and specifically, you know, gifted, I guess, in that realm, but that it could be whatever dog happens to be living there could possibly be trained in that regard. So that's fantastic, and yet another you know, sign of just how incredible dogs are. So John Bradshaw, we have reached the end of our time. Thanks very much for making the time to join us again. The book is Dog Sense: How the New Science of Dog Behavior Can Make You a Better Friend to Your Pet. John Bradshaw, thanks a lot for your great book and great work, and we'll look forward to more in the future as well.
Great pleasure to join you.
Thank you very much. All right. I'm Duncan Strauss, and you're listening to Talking Animals, where the show website is talkinganimals.net. It's time to proceed to name that animal tune. There'll be a prize, a copy of John Bradshaw's book, Dog Sense, to the first person who, in this case, emails talkinganimals@AOL.com and correctly identifies this animal tune. It's Name That Animal Tune on Talking Animals.
Toes. When you're on the street, you got to be able to pick out the easy meat with your eyes closed. Then moving silently downwind and out of sight, you got to strike when the moment is right without thinking.
All right. If you can name that animal tune, in this case, we're doing it by email today. Part of our, is he there? Is he not there? Approach to Talking Animals. So, again, send an email to talkinganimals@AOL.com if you are the first to do so and correctly identify this animal tune that we just had. Then you will win, indeed, a copy. John Bradshaw's book, Dog Sense, How the New Science of Dog Behavior Can Make You a Better Friend to Your Pet. All right, so this is Talking Animals on WMNF, and I'm Duncan Strauss. We're going to hear another animal song, this one dog-related, and also kind of at a certain point, about a dog dreaming. This is, in fact, yet another fabulous animal song recommended by the equally fabulous Nancy Creedon. This is a Kaiser Cartel with Dog Stars on Talking Animals.
Ball.
Kaiser Cartel with Dog Stars. A lovely song about a lovely, lovely scene, a lovely canine scene. We have just about reached the end of today's edition of Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa. We'll be back next Wednesday, July 6th at 11 a.m. for another edition. I hope you'll join me then. I also hope you'll visit our website, talkinganimals.net. where we make available all sorts of information as well as archives and podcasts of past Talking Animals shows. We also have a link to the... all right, that's okay. We'll figure this out, no prob. We also have a link to the Talking Animals Facebook page and our Twitter feed. And, then we'll just substitute right in there. We don't care. We're in phase. Anyway, again, yeah, Facebook page, Twitter feed, all are there on talkinganimals.net. Talking Animals Broadcast Outreach Consultant is Libby McCannon. My thanks to her. I'm Duncan Struss. Thanks very much for listening. Have a good week. Be kind to animals. Be kind to others. Be kind to yourself. Stay tuned for the fabulous Scott Elliott. The All Souls version of It's the Music, airing next from noon to 3. We're closing out today's show, as always, with an animal tune. This one, a selection from the Talking Animals Festival CD, which features 16 tracks, at least one animal song from each of the 13 bands who performed at the festival in April. We'll be offering this as a thank you gift on our Fun Drive show, July 13th, 2 weeks from today. And but if you want to make sure to get one, you can pledge now. $50 is all we're asking to support Talking Animals and WMNF. You can email me at duncan@wmnf.org, and we will get you all fixed up, get you one of these hot items ahead of time. Right now, from that Talking Animals Festival CD, this is the Sun Society with their wonderful version of Octopus's Garden, taking us right up to the NPR News, and then Scott Elliott and his great, great show right here on WMNF Tampa. We'll catch you next week on Talking Animals.
Thank you.